When your mind has been saturated with the feel of the element, go through the procedure as outlined up to the point where you visualize the doorway in front of you. Then imagine a ray of light projecting from your center of consciousness to the doorway and travel along it until you have passed through. Patience is really all that is needed should you find this stage difficult. And it is here your concentration exercises begin to pay dividends. They will have taught you how to hold the image of the doorway for long periods. So even when first attempts fail, you can aim again without having to go back to the card. Once through the doorway, you should feel it strongly as standing behind you. Since you will now find yourself in a neutral environment, it is as well to mark the position of the doorway in relation to surrounding scenery. Even though you are still fully conscious of the physical world, this is an important exercise since it plants the seeds of habit. Should you, by accident or design, find consciousness of the physical has slipped away, the doorway is your exit from the astral. Without it, the situation can become very unpleasant indeed. Israel Regardi makes the point in one of his shorter essays that the elemental doorways are absolutes. They have a universal application as gates into specific levels of the astral plane. But what each person finds on the other side of the doorway varies. When you fly to America, the scenery in Texas is very different from the scenery in Alaska. Certain standard features will remain, however. They may be no more than loose associations, or, especially if you meditated on the element beforehand, they may form an obvious motif. For your first trips, only short explorations should be undertaken. With longer trips, the danger of losing physical consciousness is greater, and this situation can have its problems if you are not familiar with astral plane peculiarities. In the early stages, content yourself with learning your way around a controlled day, dream. Very little can happen to you, and you are building up valuable experience for future more dramatic trips. There are a number of technical methods for increasing reality tone in astral visions, as well as methods for inducing trance. Neither should be used by beginners, so I will leave deals of them to a later chapter. The question of guides on the astral plane may produce some cynicism amongst readers unfamiliar with the occult. This is a question I also propose to discuss later. But since astral guides play some part in descriptions of experimental trips given in the next chapter, I would ask you simply to accept them at the moment as part of the visions. Original book paging had this heading on top of page 34. Chapter 5, The Visions and the Dreams. The first attempt to use an elemental doorway produced results as unfortunate as the earlier abortive path working. Nick Van Vliet chose the Earth Square. But once he tried the technique, he became ill again. B also tried using the Earth Square, but although her reaction was not so violent as that of her husband, she was unable to make it work. The Fruida's attempts lasted about half an hour before a fresh approach was tried using the Fire Triangle. It seemed likely that Nick Van Vliet, a trained visualizer, would make the breakthrough. But it was, in fact, B who suddenly discovered the trick of passing through the doorway. She proved a rare subject, for she found the astral to have reality tone from the outset. Once through the doorway, she retained only a thread of consciousness of her physical surroundings. My own feeling is there was at least a degree of trance involved. Not wanting to risk breaking her vision, I made no tests. But her body seemed totally relaxed and her breathing was noticeably deepened, two signs which frequently occur with trance. She told us of her trip as she experienced it, speaking slowly and carefully. Afterwards, she wrote the account given below. The guide who approached me and returned my greeting with his hands together in front of his body, was rather young with black, wavy, shoulder-length hair, wearing a white tunic held by a gold belt, bare feet in sandals with gold strap round his calves. We went together along a short path and approached a Jendi plus the Visions and the Dreams sloping hill. We went up, and when we came to the top I could see a very large lake, the water of which looked a beautiful deep blue. We went down a hill towards the lake and, as we were both panting slightly, my guide beckoned me to sit down beside him. We got up after a few minutes and continued our way to the right, along the lake. After some time we came to a grotto and my guide wanted me to enter it. I was afraid, because I felt there was something utterly wrong. Something was utterly wrong. Even watching her, we could see this. Bee's breathing quickened, her muscles tensed, and she began to move around uneasily in her chair. Had she been a more experienced traveler, it might have been interesting to leave her alone and see what happened. But as it was her first trip, I decided she had better come out. In view of her trance-like state, the method I used was suggestion. First I asked her to breathe deeply and relax. Then I told her I would join her on the astral plane and lead her back to the doorway. She responded quickly to the suggestions and calmed down. Next, I described in detail how I was passing through the doorway and walking down the same path she had taken. I followed the route of her journey and eventually told her she could now see me. She confirmed that this was so. From that point, it was simply a question of leading her verbally back to the doorway. When she passed through, she opened her eyes no worse for the experience. She had, she explained, become convinced that if she entered the grotto, her guide would desert her. Bee Van Vliet was unusual in her degree of penetration into the astral plane on a first trip. Her consciousness was almost wholly absorbed by the astral environment. This is something which normally does not occur without a good deal of practice. But some individuals are prone to a trance experience from the first. And what happened to Bee underlines my warning that astral journeys are not to be taken lightly. Certainly they should not be undertaken if you are alone, at least until you know what you are doing. P35 down. Bee's breakthrough seemed to open the way for her husband. Using the fire triangle, Nick now found he could project through the doorway. There was a difference of degree between his experience and that of his wife. Although the visions were vivid, as might be expected, he was always fully conscious of the physical world. Like Bee, he wrote out an account of his trip. The guide who approached me and returned my greeting with his hands together in front of his body was rather young. He was dressed in a short white tunica, held by a brown belt, and wore sandals. His hair was short and dark blonde. After greeting me, he beckoned me to follow him and went ahead along a winding path lined on both sides with young birches. The atmosphere was very spring-like. The guide looked around several times, as if to make sure I was still following. After a while, the path led into a dark forest which we passed through very quickly. It opened out suddenly onto a gently sloping hill with, on top of the hill, a small, white temple, the front of which was dominated by a big, rectangular blue door. When the door opened, the guide led me into the only hall the temple seemed to consist of. Right in the middle of the hall was a big rectangular black, marble or highly polished granite, pedestal with a dog figure strongly resembling the Egyptian Anubis. The guide went ahead of me and when the Anubis figure was in line between us, he turned round, raised both his arms and looked at me. Then he pointed at something on the right-hand corner of the back wall. When I came closer, I could distinguish a large blue panel with hieroglyphs in relief. Trying to read the long rows of characters, I could only make out the first three of the top line. A lapse of memory. Immediately after the trip he drew four of the characters. They were line outlines and looked a little like the letters S, U, or O, L and C. When I asked my guide for the meaning of this, he replied, "This is the light." After this he led me back the same way we had come. Nick Van Vliet's second astral trip also took him to a hilltop temple. Again the outline is given in his own words. This time my guide was older, middle-aged, and had the dark skin and almost black eyes of a Middle Eastern race. He was dressed in a long burnous-type garment, striped lengthwise in red, blue and white. Again he greeted me with both hands together in front of his body and gestured me to follow him. This time the landscape was desert, ochre, sometimes deepening to orange, sandy hills. First rather close together, then, after turning to the right, widening. Again a temple on top of a hill, but with an infant smaller and less significant looking. This time we did not enter a hall, but first had to pass through a long and rather dark corridor. It opened out into a big rectangular hall, still rather dark, but splendidly decorated with very modern-looking structures in gold, covering walls and ceiling. The shape of these structures reminded me very much of the metal sculptures of Navin Garbo. We passed through this hall without stopping, into another corridor. After a while I began to notice a strong glow of intense blue color ahead of me. Although still faint at first, there was an intensity about it mainly because of the type of blue. When we entered the next hall, I noticed that the blue glow came from behind a black, rectangular altar that was positioned almost against the back wall and in the center of it. It was flanked by two enormous bird-like figures with outstretched wings and heads like horses. These figures seemed to be made of pure gold. When approaching the altar, the blue light disappeared and I could see an old man dressed in a black robe standing behind it. My guide stayed behind me, slightly to the left. The old man's mouth was moving as if he was talking, but I couldn't hear a sound. I moved even closer but I still couldn't hear him. His left arm was raised and he was pointing upwards. Altered down P37 for some reason I did not look at what he might have been showing me. I was constantly trying to focus on his face, but it kept changing so rapidly, almost frantically, that he seemed to have 100 faces at the same time. His movement of talking became more frantic also and I had to give up. I asked my guide to bring me back and he did so, without further incidents, along the same way we had come. The fire symbolism is much more apparent in this vision than in the previous ones. Afterwards, Nick made some rough sketches of the altar and the winged figures. Those are reproduced as figure 5. Among other points of interest is the fact that, judging from the sketch, the winged figure looks very like the Egyptian Gu, or astral body. The Middle Eastern associations of the guide may have some bearing here. In theory, this vision concluded the first set of experiments. In practice there was a curious sequel. That night, in a vivid, sleeping, dream, B retraced her astral journey. The most intriguing thing about this dream was that, in it, she used the astral doorway. When she went through, she met a new guide, a quiet, old man dressed in a faded gray monk's habit. Together they went down by the same lake and eventually approached the grotto. The guide beckoned B to follow him and this time she went in. Now she takes up the story in her own words. Inside it was very dark. My guide walked a few steps in front of me and we went along what seemed to me an endless, narrow winding path until we reached a junction. My guide suddenly turned to face me and shrugged slightly as if to tell me that the decision to go to the left or to the right was all mine. Without hesitating, I chose the right-hand path and again we went along a narrow, winding path until we came to B tunnel. Here the path widened and led into a large vault. In the middle stood a black, highly polished pedestal. This was empty. My guide walked around it three times. I did the same. Then we continued along a short, narrow path and reached a second vault. In the middle of it stood the statue of a very beautiful middle-aged man. Although this was not on a pedestal, I knew at once that in fact it belonged to the pedestal that I saw in the first vault. I was very impressed by the beauty of the statue and stepped forward to have a closer look at it. As I did so, very suddenly the statue slowly turned its head to the left. At that moment, an immense sadness came over me. I asked my guide to bring me back and he did so. We went the same way we had come. The experience made a strong impression on B. The continuity between dream and vision was obvious. She decided the reason for her sadness in the dream was that she had taken the wrong turning. She was determined to try the other one. At the first possible opportunity, she used the fire doorway to re-enter the astral. It should be obvious by now that the symbol was the key to a very specific level of B's mind. She found herself in the same surroundings and was met by the guide of her dream. They walked to the grotto and this time she chose the left-hand path. My guide led me along a winding path and suddenly I saw a faint green glow. My guide now moved with his back against the wall. Impulsively I did the same, although I was wondering why my guide behaved so strangely. Suddenly I understood. The green glow fell partly over the path and, moving the way he did, my guide was out of its reach. Then I got a great shock. On the right side of the path I saw the thing that radiated this poisonous, evil green glow. It was a monster, nearly human, starved and caged. In the center of its head there was a huge eye and this was the source of the green glow. My guide led me very quickly past this monster and we went along the path until we reached a huge vault. Along the walls there were 9 statues on black, highly polished pedestals. They were all very beautiful young naked men. They looked very Rodin-like. P41 Dop. After a quick look round we went on and nearly immediately came to a second vault. Here the path stopped and against the back wall of the vault there raised very impressively and frighteningly, a huge fire column. To my disappointment, the 9 pedestals here present were empty. On each one there was a small pile of ash. My guide turned at once and hurried me back the same way we had come. Today, B. Van Vliet has abandoned all occult work. She found it too fascinating, and feared it might take a grip on her attention to the exclusion of everything else. She fancied she had an aptitude for psychism and I agree. Certainly these first few astral experiments triggered something. She dreamed again. Not a trip this time, and not even anything very spectacular. She had lost a compact and subsequently found it in the garden. It was an odd compact. It was triangular and green. And then a recurring dream began, the first recurring dream she ever had. It played back for 3 consecutive nights, vividly. She was driving an old open car along a quiet country road. It broke down. After trying to fix it and trying to push it, she decided to get help. She could not find help and was walking back towards the car when a young, strong black elephant came charging towards her. It was a beautiful animal and she admired it without fear, as it went past. Then, out of the blue, a disembodied voice said, "Well, you see, there is still some wildlife here." In Hindu mythology, the elephant Ganesha supports the world from the back of a turtle. Occultists maintain that the physical world is supported by the astral plane. The number 9, in her vision of the statues, is the Kabbalistic number of Yesod, sphere of the Azal. And there were a number of other symbols in these and later visions that would be recognized by an occultist. All this sounds very mysterious, but isn't. It simply points to the archetypal nature of occult symbolism. But the futural plane is not simply symbol juggling. I gave these visions and dreams to show what you see Lane expect from reasonably straightforward PS. Later you will find out what can happen when the trips are not straightforward. Meanwhile you can learn about some other doors. Top B43 Chapter 6, The Tarot Doorways. These cards, originally made of metal or strong leather, were later used as a means of gambling, just as the Egyptian priests intended them. For they knew that the human race will never die and so their mysterious cards were unknowingly used by the barbarians as a means of transmission, throughout subsequent ages, of the most sacred and hidden results, attained by the old wisdom of Egypt, Mauni Sadhu, the tarot. A tarot deck is composed of 78 cards. 56 of these are divided into suits, wands, cups, swords and pentacles, equating with the familiar diamonds, hearts, spades and clubs. The remaining 20 are the tarot trumps, a curious collection of symbolic pictures. There is a game of tarot, but I have never seen it played. The last person I met who owned a tarot deck was learning to tell fortunes with it. She was following a long tradition. Among Romanies, real and fairground, the tarot has an excellent reputation as a fortune-telling deck. Each suit is numbered 8 to 10, but there are 4 court cards rather than the 3 found in an ordinary pack. These 4 are valet, knight, queen and king. Each card has a series of traditional associations, which usually change when the card is reversed. The 4 of swords, for instance, means solitude, retreat or abandonment when taken right way up. Reversed, it means economy, precaution or regulation of expenditure. This consideration applies only to the minor arcana. The major arcana, as the trumps are called, have the same meaning whichever way they are dealt. Fascinating though the subject is, I would be stepping out of line if I started to go into fortune telling detail here. But it may have some bearing on the subject of astral operations to mention that one reason why the tarot has proved so popular in this field is that the trumps, by nature of their symbolic value, can have a very stimulating effect on the intuition. Only the trumps are used as astral doorways. Unfortunately, there is controversy about how these trumps should look. If Sadhu's thesis is correct, The priests of ancient Egypt presumably knew the answer. But in the years since then, design details have been modified to produce a variety of packs. This sort of situation is probably to be expected. It is complicated further by the attempts of modern occultists to restore the accurate and ancient symbolism. The designs in Mauni Sadhu's book were made, presumably to his instructions, by Mrs. E. G. Lucas of Melbourne. Aleister Crowley. Lady Harris designed his variations on the theme. A. E. Waite produced another pack in association with the publishing house of Ryder and Company. There are several different packs on sale even today. My own came from the Metaphysical Research Group at Futches Court, Hastings. Their medieval ugliness appalls my ear, but their symbolism must be reasonably accurate because they work. The trumps are numbered 0 to 20, one as follows. Oh. The Fool. A thin, faced bearded man walking through the countryside. In his right hand he holds a staff. In his left, a stick gl. And over the right shoulder. Tied to this stick is a little bag for HR9 Bglongs. A mischievous dog is tearing the seat of his pants. The fool wears a necklace of bells, five of which can be seen on the card. The Magician. This name can denote a magus or a conjurer. My own card shows the latter, although other packs differ. The Magician stands behind a low table on which are various tools of his trade. One hand is raised and holding a small wand. The sweeping brim of his enormous hat makes the sign of infinity. 2. The High Priestess. A fairly complex collection of symbols. The priestess sits between twin pillars D in which appear the letters Tlutaro, published by George Alcon and Unwin Limited 1962. The Tarot doorways Boa and Jack, presumably portions of the Masonic pillar names Boaz and Jackin. On her head is a horned tiara, WLTH a discord globe at its center. From this a veil drapes down, but does not cover her face. On her breast is an equal, armed, elemental, cross. She is holding a scroll in her hand, partly hidden by the veil. The letters Torah appear on this, probably as a reference to the Hebrew scriptures. At her feet, penetrating the long robe, is a crescent moon. 3. The Empress, a robed and crowned woman holding aloft a scepter, which is surmounted by a globe. On the globe itself is an elemental cross, while above it is a Calvary cross. The Empress is throned in pleasant, sylvan surroundings with a cornfield stretching from her feet. Beside the throne is a heart-shaped shield on which is prominently displayed the astrological sign of Venus. 4. The Emperor. A powerfully built crowned and bearded figure seated on a large, impressive throne. Each arm of the throne is finished in a ram's head, while the corners of the back panel are surmounted by two snakes. In his left hand the Emperor holds an orb, topped by a Calvary cross. In his right is a scepter shaped like the Egyptian ankh. 5. The Hierophant or Pope. Seated between twin pillars with two ministers kneeling at his feet, the mitred Hierophant has his right hand raised in the familiar papal blessing. Stamped on the back of his hand is a tiny Maltese goss. In his left hand is a staff surmounted by a triple cross, and a small elemental cross is stamped on this hand. 6. The Lovers, the eternal triangle of a man flanked by two women. Above them a Cupid figure, framed in a blazing sun, is about to unloose a shaft. The traditional interpretation of this card is man caught between vice and virtue, while love conspires to kill off vice. At least one other interpretation has been put forward in more esoteric terms by the Kabbalist MacGregor Mathers. 7. The Chariot. A young, crown conqueror drives a cubical chariot drawn by two white horses. In his right hand he holds a scepter while on each shoulder appears an upturned face. Directly in front of the horses is a single flower, possibly a rose. On the chariot itself is a heart-shaped insignia with the letters AGZ, interpretation of which defeats me. 8. Justice. A crowned woman seated on a throne, the uprights of which form the familiar twin pillars. In her right hand she holds an upright broadsword. In her left, she carries the scales, perfectly balanced. 9. The Hermit. A slightly stooping, bearded old man in a flowing monk's habit. The hermit carries a lamp held aloft in his right hand. In his left a staff or a wand, curves or the top to vanish into the folds of his robe. 10. The Wheel of Fortune. The graphics of this one are so crude as to be almost impossible to interpret. The wheel is a crude contraption revolving on a spindle between two uprights. My card shows 6 spokes. Mathers insists 7 is the correct number. 2 animals are bound to the wheel, one ascending and the other descending. At first glance, the animals might be dogs. They could also be monkeys, and one at least gives the vague impression of having a fish-like tail. Above the wheel is an equally difficult figure, crowned and carrying a sword. Mathers describes it as an angel or sphinx. It could equally well be a monkey, nun or dog. 11. Strength. A beautiful cloaked woman wearing a hat very similar to that of the magician in Trump 1. The woman, with every appearance of ease, is restraining the jaws of a savage lion. 12. The Hanged Man. One of the most curiously fascinating cards in the Major Fukina. The man hangs by 1 foot from a rough rectangular structure composed of 3 very roughly worked tree branches. His hands are bound behind his back so that the position of the arms and upper body form a triangle. His free right leg is bent to form a cross with the left. I once saw an Indian fake ear hang in almost an identical manner as part of his yogic disciplines. 13. Death. The Grim Reaper is a skeleton equipped with a scythe with which he mows down a variety of human heads, hands and feet growing in a meadow. 14. Temperance. A robed and winged angel pours liquid from one egg to another. On her brow is an insignia composed of 6 points, probably a solar symbol. 15. The Devil. A horned and bat, winged demon stands on a small, circular altar. His feet are clawed and in his left hand he holds upright a short, flat sword. Roped to the altar are 2 smaller demons. 16. The Lightning, Struck Tower. Another symbol with a curious fascination. A small brick tower with 3 windows, the top of which, shaped like a crown, has been split off, apparently by lightning although the sun shines strongly and the sky is clear. Flames erupt from the split and rubble falls. 2 men are falling headlong. According to Mathers, one of them is in an attitude which forms the Hebrew letter in. 17. The Star. A beautiful, naked woman kneels to pour water from her vessels onto the ground. Directly above her head is a huge 5-pointed star, flanked by 7 others, all slightly smaller. 18. The Moon. The moon shines on a river beside which 2 dogs, or a dog and a wolf, howl. Beside the animals are 2 towers and beneath the foot of one is an unrolled scroll bearing the letters M, A. Calling out of the river onto the bank is a crayfish. 19. The Sunday. A blazing sun dominates this card. It shines on a field of growing sunflowers behind a low wall. In the forefront a naked child carrying a flowing banner rides a white horse. 20. The Judgment. A flying angel blows a horn to which is attached a standard emblazoned with the elemental cross. Beneath, the dead rise white and naked from their tombs. 21. The Universe. A laurel wreath with a flower at the cardinal points surrounds a nude female, or hermaphrodite, figure draped in a small veil and carrying a short wand in each hand. One of the figure's legs is crossed over the other in the manner of the Hanged Man. Beyond the wreath, in the corners of the card, an angel, woman and an eagle, and, at bottom, a bull and a lion. It is possible that bad graphics in a tarot deck, and those in mine are indiscutibly bad, have little influence on the card's usefulness. Presented with a cutted outline, the mind fills in its own detail dot and coloring. Hopefully the detail springs from a deep enough level of the unconscious to produce results. In itself, the tarot is a remarkable system for esoteric study. And in themselves the cards can be used as astral doorways. The technique to use is even more simple than tie of the elemental doorways. First choose your card. Spend a little time in meditation on it. Whether or not these symbols actually date to Pharaonic Egypt is open to question, but they are certainly very ancient. As such, they repay investigation. Once you are familiar with the card, close your eyes and visualize the scene it shows. Take time to fill in THC details and make the picture as vivid as possible. Enlarge it, then, walk into it and keep walking.